Welcome to the Ripple Revolution podcast. In this podcast, we take a new look at how we think about making a difference, with an approach that integrates the work we do in our own lives and the difference we make in the world. After penning a bestseller called The Women's Comfort Book, she became widely known as the Comfort Queen. While she loved the difference she was making in women's lives, she also felt limited by being boxed in as the Comfort Queen. She realized that there was an important aspect missing from what she was doing. That aspect was making a difference. And with that, the seeds were planted for her current focus on both savoring and serving.
Hello, Jen. Thanks so much for joining me here on the Ripple Revolution podcast. I am completely amped to hear what you've got to share with me today.
Well, I love what you're up to. I think the Ripple Revolution and what I have read and what you wrote for my website a while back is just so succinct and so brilliant and so right on. So I'm happy to do anything I can to help that ripple revolute.
We have a little revolutin' going today.
Let's revolute.
So one of the reasons I wanted to interview you is when we originally talked about all of this, it was really obvious that we're kindred spirits mm-hmm. in the ideas behind this and what it is that we're doing. So for me, it's this Ripple Revolution idea, and for you, you've got this idea of savor and serve. So I think what I'd like to do to start this off is really just throw that open and say, what is that all about? What is savor and serve, and what are the ideas there?
Yeah, the idea behind it was for many years my website was comfortqueen.com, and I had a book with that in the title and a character in the book named the Comfort Queen, and people started to call me the Comfort Queen. And in retrospective, you know, none of this mattered, but I got really freaked out over the years about it. I felt like I was being pigeonholed into only talking about self-love and self-care and comfort. And these things were very important to me in my 30s, and I was an early pioneer and a very early voice in that work. And I do think it's incredibly important work, and I can say more about that in a moment. But it started to feel like it wasn't embracing the whole of me, and it wasn't embracing the social justice, and especially for me, environmental justice. I feel deeply passionate about global warming and waking people up to understanding how we can, that doesn't have to be inevitable, and I feel very passionate about women's rights. And so I was like, oh, it's time for something different. It's time for a different expression of my work. And I was exploring what that would be, and a couple different conversations with important mentors led me to a misquote of E.B. White, the essayist and former New Yorker editor and, of course, author of Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little. And I'm leaning right now on my dog named Stuart. and there's a misquote of his that basically is like, I wake up in the morning not knowing whether I should save the world or savor the day. And it makes it hard to choose. And it's not exactly what he said, but it really brought me to the understanding that it was bringing the two together is what we need to be doing as people. The model of saving the world is such a misnomer and has led to so much heartache and wasted energy and lost aid. And the idea of just savoring, the self-care part that I was helping people with, is super important, but I also was seeing people stop there. You know, they didn't know how to knit the two together. And so I think that where I am in my life is trying to learn to be whole, and to serve wholeness. And so savor and serve is my idea about that. And I thought it would be like one of those adventures like the Year of Living Biblically, right? And I would write about it, and I would have all these experiments, and I would write a best-selling book. And like 2 months into it, I'm like, oh, my God, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is how I'm supposed to live. It's not a frickin' book. It's how I'm supposed to live. I'm supposed to savor. I'm supposed to serve. And so I kind of lost interest in making it a gimmick. And then people were like, what happened to savor and serve? I'm like, oh, no, I'm doing it. I'm just doing it. That's what I'm interested in. Come along if you want, but there's not going to be any cute little experiments.
I'm sorry. I'm living it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I decided living it. I'm savoring it. I'm savoring this whole thing. Yeah.
So with the connection between the savor and serve, what do you see as the connection there?
Oh, you can't do one without the other. You can't do one without the other. See, what I mean by that is if you're not loving this world, then you're separate from it. And then you're trying to be the martyr or the savior. Neither one of those archetypes are sustainable, nor do they actually lead to lasting change for the people or the animals or the environments that you're trying to help. They're a top-down, they're a hierarchical, they're a patriarchal model. If you're not savoring and you're trying to serve, you burn out. There's no connection to yourself, to your heart. You can't find what you're passionate about to serve on, to serve in, to serve with. You're not led by your desire, you're led by your ideas, and that leads to all kinds of miscommunication and burnout and again, that top-down, I know better than you. I know the good old Christian ethic of service. If you would just do what I say to do, then you wouldn't have these problems, right? We could also say the Republican Party's view of service. Sorry, not to get political, but you know, sort of the Ronald Reagan years of service. If you people just do what I say and get your life together and make sure you're married, in the meantime, then you'll be okay. I also think savoring is what keeps us open-hearted. It breaks our hearts open. If we're not savoring, then we're not growing, right? Everything becomes sort of dead and distanced. It's very hard to savor. It requires us to slow down. It requires us to be imperfect. It requires us to feel. And that's really the tender part of this equation.
Right. And, you know, something that you said there, I had another question that I'll get back to perhaps, but something that you said there really pounced on something that I think is so important, and that is this idea of, now I don't even remember the exact word that you said, but it was about this imperfection. It was about really just one of the things that I love about what you do and your writing and the things that I see you putting out there is that there is this authenticity you bring that has to do with, guess what, I'm human, I'm imperfect, and that's what life is all about.
And welcome to my typos.
Exactly.
I'm dyslexic to boot.
It does lower the bar, doesn't it?
It does.
So let's talk a little bit about this idea of imperfection and the flip side, which is how many of us have bought into this notion that we're somehow supposed to be perfect and the impact that has on us. Talk about the power of imperfection.
Right, the power of imperfection and being ordinary. Well, mm-hmm. There's so many reasons why it's important. One is that so often we don't serve because we think if we're not Martin Luther King or we're not Mother Teresa or we're not Bono, I can never say his name right. See, there's some imperfection for you. I always call him Bono, who I think was with Cher. then what's the point of us doing anything? So embracing our imperfection lets us say, oh, well, what can I do imperfectly today? And I think about these poor kids that did the Boston horrible things. And I don't know them, and obviously we'll never know quite what happened. But I keep thinking about that, the older boy talking about hating America and being lonely and not having any friends. And I know this is so simplistic, but just take this one little bit from it, everybody. What if people's idea of service around him, without knowing it was for him or what was going to happen, had been to reach out to people who seem lonely? You know, and we overlook those gifts of ours because they're as close as our nose and they're as familiar as our nose, and we judge them like we judge our noses. So imperfection and savoring allows us to see those things and to value them as they unfold without being attached to them being big. That was another thing I had to learn about savor and serve. I wanted it to be big. I wanted my service to be big. I was planning this whole thing in India, right? And I had to cancel it all because I realized it was stupid to fly to India to do service just from a carbon standpoint. So I don't know. I kind of got off on a little tangent there. But I think the imperfection and the ordinariness of who we are is where our genius lives. And we overlook how we can serve when we overlook that. We downplay our gifts so we don't get the juice back from when we do serve that way. And then the third thing is that we don't develop our gifts, and we often fall into resignation and doing nothing because we're not valuing them, because we don't think they're big enough or perfect enough or extraordinary enough.
Right, right. And I think that there is such power. Power seems to be my word of the day. There is such power in recognizing how much potential there is to make a difference in the world purely by the small things.
And we love, our society right now does not value those small things, really. I mean, we give lip service to it, but we value in, because it makes good media, we value the stories of somebody like the guy who started charitywater.org, right? Charity, no, it's just water.org, right? And that's great, and he's great, and he's doing great work. But if that's our only model, sort of this slick former nightclub guy who could put together this and has no, that just, you know, it's just going to negate all of us. If we decide that the only way to serve is to start our own nonprofit, I mean, that is another story I see so often. I got to do my own thing. It's like, no, you don't need to do your own thing. There's plenty of good things going. You can just be part of those, right?
Absolutely.
You don't need to do a service trip. You know, service trips often do more harm than good. Why don't you raise money and send it to India? That's what we did. Yeah.
And I think that certainly, if you are called to do, say, the social entrepreneurship thing, or called to create some kind of NGO, then fabulous. That's wonderful. If it's really coming from what you're called to do, but doing it because that is what this external definition of what mattering looks like, limits the potential that we have.
Oh, yeah, and it also is, are we doing it because it makes us feel good, or are we doing it because it's of service? And I think savoring helps soften maybe that attachment to our ego, because the ego can just be rampant when it comes to service, you know, and it can be under this cover of, oh, look what I'm doing. I'm doing it for everybody else, right? We started watching last night. It's very potty mouth. But Veep, V-E-E-P, it's the Julia Louis Dreyfus series on HBO. You can get it on DVD. We don't have HBO. And it's very, very raunchy and very cynical, everybody. We laughed our bottoms off. And she has this moment where they think the president's having a heart attack, and she gets to go be in control. And then she gets like 15, 20 minutes later, he's okay. And you can just, she plays it so well, because you're like, see, where she's like, are you sure he's okay? Because she's really liking being in the Oval Office and being in the Situation Room and being in control, right? And that's, I just loved it. I loved the rawness and the authenticity of how she was playing it, because that's how we are about service sometimes, right? It's power. Your word of the day. And I think savoring can help us soften around that and feel into our humanity and our connection. And then however we serve starts to have value, and we can find a way that's more, less about us and more about everything, more about wholeness.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I was wanting to take a look at earlier, you had been talking about coming from the heart. And I think that is such an important piece of the whole puzzle, and something that is so missing in general, in the general ethos of our culture, is coming from the heart. And that's one of the things that I'm so glad that you're out there doing, is because my impression is that that's really just woven into how you approach things and what you talk about. So let's talk a little bit about that. A, what does that mean to you? And then B, what do you see, what helps people start to take a look at that and say, well, how do I come from the heart?
Mm. I want to say that I am a person of privilege. And I think I often wonder if I would be able to be as heart-based if I wasn't. And by privilege, I mean I have enough to eat. I live in a beautiful, safe place. I am in a loving relationship. I have a daughter who's doing really well in the world. You know, I have enough money in the bank to take care of myself. And those things make it a lot easier for me to be heart open. And I think if I had to live in an inner city slum and deal with grinding poverty and working at McDonald's, I don't think I would do well. So I really want to say that because I think being heart-based for some people is possible anywhere, but it's, I don't know that it would be for me. And so I really see how much it is a product of how I've been able to construct my life. And yes, I've worked hard and I've made a lot of choices to construct my life that way. But, I mean, it wasn't given to me or anything, but, you know, it is part of what allows me to live this way. A lot of quiet, a lot of silence, a lot of time outside, a lot of time snuggling with my dogs. You know, I don't have to deal with the big, hard city world or a lot of intense poverty. So anyway, important caveat for me. Then I think the other thing that I would say, the flip side of that, is I really was built this way. Like I've always been this way my whole life, and it has its pluses and it has its minuses, because you feel a lot, right? And you feel suffering a lot, and it can get to be too much.
Sure.
But I think the real way that I've opened it or grounded myself in my heart, so it's not idiot compassion, it's not just wanting to take care of everybody and give everything away, but it honors me too, is through meditation and yoga and through really learning to stay with experiences and not judge them or shut them down. And I think that's the practice we all need. We need some kind of awareness practice. It's awareness. I think that's how we open our hearts. But it's awareness that has to be attached to our hearts. It can't be just intellectual and cold.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
it's a long-winded answer.
Absolutely. So what does awareness mean to you there as you're talking about that?
So it's awareness means many things to me. It means that I'm aware that I am an observer who is constructed through life experiences and through my biology and through my gender and through my privilege to observe the world a certain way, and that I'm wearing a pair of glasses. The world is not the way that I see it. It is the way that I see it through my glasses. So I try to be aware of those glasses and how they're shaping my conclusions, my choices, my judgments. I am aware on another level that awareness is aware of me, that something is always aware that I'm being aware, and I'm very curious about that. Is that God? Is that consciousness? What is aware of me having this conversation, being aware I'm having this conversation? I love that. It's so wild to me, and it's when I feel my most free. I'm aware when I can be that I'm part of a larger whole, that it's not about me. Which is so freeing, because then I can feel more playful to follow my desires and slow down and to savor how I serve. Aware of my patterns, aware of all the ways I get in my own way, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Drinking red wine last night, you know, even a little bit of red wine makes me sick. And I really was, the weather here has been so spectacular. It's just like, it's an orgasm outside every single moment. It's just spring on steroids. And sometimes that feels celebratory. So I poured some red wine last night, aware that I did that, you know. So I woke up a little bit in the middle of the night, you know, and felt a little tiny bit dull this morning. Just aware of that pattern, aware of that story.
So so you're talking about really an awareness practice being key to coming from that heart place. How does that open the access to that heart place?
You have to link the two. You have to link the two. And so one way to link it is with great self-compassion. And going back to the earlier part of our conversation about being okay with who I am, learning to be okay with who I am. So learning to practice self-compassion instead of self-cruelty, learning to live in a more, to look at my awareness as an opportunity to be curious and to take a teeny tiny baby step in a different direction towards freedom and greater choice, not towards fixing or perfection. And to know and notice and practice noticing that everyone is doing the best they can, right? Everyone is doing the best they can. And part of the privilege of doing the work that I've done in the last 20-some years is getting to be in circle and be in individual conversations with so many people in so many different settings that you really realize that everybody is going through life with so much pain and suffering. You know, even those of us who are very privileged have such loss. So connecting to that with awareness, not being swamped by it, not being identified with it, being able to say, wow, yes, I understand that this is something that we're all feeling. I spoke at a high school a couple weeks ago that has had some suicides, some teenage suicides, and one of the things I said is, you know, when you're really feeling the despair, could you just imagine in that moment that maybe there's one other person in the world that feels similar? Maybe nobody you know, maybe someone halfway around the world. So those kind of practices, meta-meditation, you know, where you wish for yourself to be well, to be safe, to be loved, and maybe for somebody else the same. I think those are the kind of things that help us connect awareness to our hearts.
Yep, absolutely. There was something, as I was looking at your webpage, there was something you were talking about. It was describing what your books are about, and it was how to create a life of wholeness based on self-kindness and self-acceptance.
Mm.
And going back to this idea of each of us is really at the heart of any impact that we make in the world, any difference that we make in the world, that is such a huge way we get in the way of
mm-hmm.
our potential to make a difference, our potential to show up in a really positive, thriving way is just how we treat ourselves. So I'd love to talk a little bit about that, because I think the kinder that we can be to ourselves and the more compassionate we can be with ourselves, the more able we are to show up in the world in a way that reflects that externally too.
Oh, gigantic, yes. All thumbs up, all toes up. Absolutely, yes, yes, yes. And research shows conclusively, lots of research, that if you want to make a difference in the world, if you want to meet your goals, if you want to have better relationships, you name it, you want it, the way to get it is not to push yourself, beat yourself up, and judge yourself. It actually makes it harder for you to move towards what you want and the impact you want to have, because think about it. You lose energy, you lose motivation, you lose self-trust. And it's almost like, do you want to spend more time with this horrible, mean person? No. And your horrible, mean person is inside of you, so you start to resort to things to lie to yourself, to go into denial, to numb out. So self-cruelty and being hard on ourselves and deciding that our actions are us, you know, equating our character with the mistakes that we make, those are all the things that actually categorically will keep us from having the impact we want to have in the world and keep us from being the people we want to be, right? They shut down the higher functions of our brain so we can't be empathetic. We can't be intuitive. We can't be caring. We're like, we're in our reptile brain. We're in our, oh my God, someone's going to eat me. I'm going to die. I better kill them first brain when we're being cruel to ourselves. So absolutely. So how do we start practicing self-compassion? Well, again, I come to awareness. I come to, how can I begin to be aware of even the fact that I am being cruel to myself? And this is one of the things I said to the high school kids. I'm like, just start listening in on how you speak to yourself. And I bet you speak to yourself, you wouldn't even speak to a sibling that you're in white hot anger, that you want to murder the way that you speak to yourself, right? You know, those moments when we really just wanted to kill our sibling or kill our parent because they're so horrible and so irritating, right? We're even more cruel to ourselves than that. So I think the first thing, again, is awareness. How are you talking to yourself? What triggers you? You know, I notice that when I get emails in the morning and I haven't done something for myself first, like something creative, and any of those emails are like asking me for something or complaining or like I feel any sort of shame touched off, right, that I haven't done something right, then I can start into a spiral of self-recrimination and shame. So start to know your triggers. And then start to wonder, like, what could I replace those voices with? Not happy making affirmations. Those do not work. They cause great cognitive dissonance, right? I am getting better and better every day. I'm so perfect. I'm a size 2 in all ways. Like, does not work. But instead, you could say to yourself, wow, I screamed at the kids again tonight. That was really felt bad. Can I just be aware that that was the choice that I made, and not why, or not that I'll do it again, or not that I need some big plan not to do it again, just to be with the pain of it, the pain of it. And then what would it be like to go back in time and look at that triggers, and what could I have said to myself, or what could I have done a little differently, just to consider it. So I don't know. I mean, there's so much to be said about this. I think Tara Brach's work, her book Radical Acceptance and True Refuge, his two books, are really helpful. And Christine Neff's work, I think it's called Self-Compassion, is her book.
Yeah, I've been listening to that audiobook, actually. It's really
good.
Yeah,
it's really good. I mean, nothing that you don't know, people. It's just a matter of practicing it, right? One of the things I've taught women for 21 years is, could you speak to yourself the way you would your best friend? Because we don't lie to our best friends, right? We're not like, that looks really good on you, honey. You know, we're like, no, back to the dressing room. But we don't say, you look like a fat pig in that. How did you even think to put that on? No one will ever love you because of the way you look. We would never even think that about our best friends. But we would say, nope, yellow polka dots, not yours, not your style. Let's go look for something that is. We can find something that'll work great.
Right. No, that's a good way of looking at that.
Yeah, best friends. And we've all had a best friend, even if it was long ago, you know, that we were really loving and honest with. And those two, that's how we want to be with ourselves. Yeah, I really screwed up with the kids. Oh, my gosh. I have not been getting enough sleep again. I have been staying up late playing Farmville. I am so sorry. And just let ourselves feel sorry. Let ourselves feel human. I need to get more sleep, and then I'm more patient. That's being human.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you were referring to there is not... You didn't use these words, but essentially not getting caught up in the story.
Yes, of course.
That we
right.
create.
Right. So it's becoming, the distinction that I make is that we become aware of the story and we don't identify with it. I think it's impossible not to have the story mechanism because of the way our brains function. But I can become less and less identified with my story. And I can just watch it and go, oh, isn't it funny? I think I'm a terrible person who should never have been allowed to have kids. Because I yelled at them last night. I screamed at them at the top of my lungs. Oh, isn't that interesting? That's the story that I'm telling myself, and that I should now eat an entire package of Oreos because I'm such a bad person, that I should punish myself for yelling at the kids by eating chocolate that will actually make me less patient and really feel bad about myself. Oh, that's so fascinating that I'm telling myself that. It's not bad. It's not wrong. And it's not me. It's not the truth. With a capital T.
Absolutely. And it's amazing to me, just using my own brain as a as a case study, it's amazing to me how one of the ways that I picture it is when something happens, you know, the safety glass on a car windshield?
Yeah.
When something shatters it.
Yeah.
When something happens, it's like the cracks of the safety glass, and it just touches everything, every little thing that I don't think I did well or that I don't like about myself or whatever it is, when in fact, actually what just happened was this one thing.
Yes, very well. Very good point, right? It's the catastrophizing. My sweetie does that, right? It's like, because the farm bill didn't happen, and because of sequestration, then we're not going to have enough money for the budget next year, and so I'm going to have to move to Mongolia. I'll never see you again, right?
It's
wait
logical
a minute.
Outcome.
Wait. I don't know. I think there might be some steps in between.
So I want to, we're coming close to the end of our time with this, which goes way, way too fast. But I want to make sure that that people have a way to find you and can find your website. Before you share that, do you have any last tips that you would give people just as far as really showing up in a whole life and savoring and serving and really showing up as fully and as lusciously as possible? in the
really
world.
Really look for the places that savoring and serving come together for you. Get really curious about it. Like, what does it mean for you to savor? Like, the first things we usually think of are food and sex. But it's so much bigger than that. Like, you can savor anything. What does it mean to you? What does it feel like in your body? And same thing about service. Like, just, you know, next time you're on the gym, you're exercising, you need something to think about, or you're on a long drive or whatever your thinking time is, just think, what is service? What are my stories about service? What are my beliefs about it? What maybe my baggage about it? You know, and where did the two come together? And you're not going to know the answer to this. This is just... there is no answer. It's just an inquiry, right? What does savoring and serving together look like for me? And then see if you can allow yourself to experience more of the two coming together. And just noticing how the more alive you are, the more alive your ability to send out a ripple into the world is. And the more effortless it is as well.
Right. Right, and the more it just naturally happens simply by showing up.
Exactly. Instead of this big, chop wood, lift the entire tree up with all of your might, right? And it becomes much more like, oh, wow, it looks really fun to sit down on the stoop right now and talk to my neighbor's 95-year-old mom. I just am so into savoring her face and her accent right now. And I'm so into listening to her story. Or for me, right now, one of the things I'm trying to savor is I go over every day and I change my mom's patch. She has Alzheimer's. And just really savoring that 15, 20 minutes that we have together. I don't like taking care of my mom, but I'm learning to savor it and to be of service that way. I feel restricted by it. It's hard, you know, but it's also something that needs to happen. So I'm trying to find the savoring way into it, not forcing it, not because it makes me a better person, but because it needs to be done. What is the way to savor it? And lately it's been being silly with her. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, I think, what you're saying there feels really important, and it's this idea of what if every day we just showed up with this one single question that we keep asking ourselves, what can I savor here? How can I savor this?
Mm, yeah, I love that. Yeah, because then maybe I think so much of us, we're wired to naturally serve, right? We're wired to naturally help. And we just saw that in Boston, you know? We see it so often in life. I do, at least. I see people
Absolutely.
Just wanting to help. I see people wanting to help each other in the grocery store. You know?
Absolutely. Excellent. So I have had so much fun, and I don't want to let you go, but here we are. I want to make sure that people can find you. So where can they find more about what it is that you do, your blog, et cetera, et cetera?
JenniferLowden.com. And that's it. I'm there. And I update the blog. I write a blog post at least once a week and sometimes twice. And I have my events there. There's a retreat in October in New York. It's for women only. Sorry. It's on creative joy. I think creative joy is a huge part of learning to savor, just to create for the sake of creating. And yeah, it's a great place. You get great stuff when you sign up, useful stuff, and fun. Good.
Excellent. Creative joy. Now, that's a whole new interview that we need to do.
Okay, we'll do that one next. That sounds great. I love talking about that, too.
Perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. And as always, I am coming away feeling inspired and ready to go out and do my thing.
Me, too.
Create
thank you.
All
I
kinds
love
of
these
goodness.
Conversations. Thank you so much.